from the beginning, I've just said there'll be surprises. And that's a surprise. Now, through my career, I've been falsely accused of saying things that I never did say. So I guess I ought to take credit for that, even though I never really predicted the earthquakes. You can predict that there will be more surprises. This is a very complex technology. There's lots of things happening. And particularly if we keep our head in the shell, we can just expect that additional surprises are going to come up and they'll be hitting us. I'm going to go quickly through a bunch of slides. Some of them are here mainly because the slide set's available and so you'll have them, but they've really been covered. Our basic bias is that it's virtually certain that all of the nation's oil and gas sources over time are going to be tapped. I'd like to be able to believe that we're going to get there by wind and solar and or nuclear and or conservation, but I don't think we're going to get there. So I think that it is inevitable that we will get most of this shale gas. So what's the rush? And that's basically, to me, the core issue. There are lots of possible benefits. You've heard about them. I won't go through them and repeat them. What we have, though, is something which I basically have been saying, stupid me, I thought that over the 40, 50 years that I've been involved in environmental and occupational health and involved with these kind of things, that we had learned how to deal with them and we weren't going to repeat the mistakes of the past. So far, with the shale gas explosion, it seems like we've forgotten all the things we knew before. Looking here at a good friend from New Jersey, I'd say this is like New Jersey in the 1970s. We just simply haven't gotten there. Let me immediately say that there's a wide range of industry response to this. There's some industries which do get it, and there's some that don't. You know, I'll show you some data on that. We're basically in a situation where we're not doing the public health research that we need to do. You've seen this slide, you understand the drilling. This is just a sort of a little close-up of a rural area of West Virginia. You can see a couple of houses over there right next door. Here's somebody whose house is basically right across the street from the drill pad. How this person will respond to that is going to depend in large part whether that's his acres and he or she are making money on it. In southwestern Pennsylvania, we have about half the people in the shale gas area do not own their mineral rights. In northeastern Pennsylvania, most do. You can expect very different community responses under those kind of circumstances. And that's what some of the Penn State surveys seem to be showing. We looked at the reasons given in a hearing that was held by President Obama's commission. This is a natural gas subcommittee of the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board. They held hearings in Washington, Pennsylvania. Public had 2 minutes to speak. There were lots of people there. They were bussed in by industry. They were bussed in by environmental groups to basically make their point. Of the 59 people who spoke against this, about two-thirds of them listed public health kind of issues as a major concern. So in their 2 minutes, health was certainly a concern. So there's no question that the public, at least who are opposed to this, who are concerned about it, are concerned about their health. Why are we worried? Lots of different reasons. You've again seen some excellent presentations on them. To our point of view, the community safety, the traffic, the explosions, the fires, the crimes. Crime rate goes up when you have lots of young men coming into other than their own area on a transient basis. That's all over the world and certainly is true so far with this. But the psychosocial disruption, the sustainability, the issue of what's going to happen long-term in communities. Again, this is a limited amount of gas. 20 years from now, after all these wonderful things have happened, perhaps because of the economic benefits, what happens when the jobs go away because the gas goes away? Can these communities go back to the rural, tourist-driven, perhaps, ecosystem values that they have now? Or will they not be able to because of these activities? That's something that needs to be looked at in much more detail. What about public health? This is the language of the executive orders creating advisory committees, one by President Obama, one by the governor of Maryland, Democrat, and one by the governor of Pennsylvania, a Republican. All three executive orders ask for advice about public health, and I've given it's in bold, the emphasis has been added to show the public health aspects. This is supposed to be a surprise to those of you who don't know it. Roxana, you gave away my punchline. Maybe I'll forgive you. But here are 52 members of these three advisory committees, and the amount of people with any public health background is zero. And, you know, public health defined as broadly as you'd like, it's zero. How does that happen when you've got three executive orders that specifically say we need information about public health? Here's committee composition. This is the Secretary of Energy's advisory board, again, established by President Obama. It's President Obama's call for this advisory committee specified that three agencies should be involved, the Department of Energy in the lead, EPA, and the Department of Interior. Where's Health and Human Services? Not there. The folks there, good people, environmental groups, Environmental Defense Fund, three academics who are chemistry, petroleum engineering, and geophysics. Not exactly health areas. Here's the Maryland one. They've got, again, good environmental groups, Nature Conservancy, a Watershed Association, and Trout Unlimited. Here's the Pennsylvania one, which actually had 31 members. If you look at the environmental groups, there's the Nature Conservancy, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, another conservancy, and an environmental council. Where's APHA, American Lung Association, Group Against Smog and Pollution, Children's Environmental Health Network? Not there. Look at the government organizations that the state of Pennsylvania has on this large advisory group. They were actually from 10 different groups. The state government agencies involved do not include the Department of Health. I'm sorry, you have a health mandate in your executive order and the Department of Health is not involved. Not surprisingly, when funding finally came out, the governor of Pennsylvania actually at first didn't want to tax the oil industry, the gas industry at all, but he finally has an impact fee. And there are 17 different agencies, sub-agencies, and commissions in Pennsylvania who are going to get that fee. Now, I mean, there's good reason to give the Fish and Boat Commission a piece of the action, but why not the Department of Health? So the original ideas that were finally put in front of this commission, which actually got to the governor about, you know, you really need to give some money to the Department of Health, $2 million a year, and we really need a surveillance approach. We need to do the kind of routine things that we know how to do, somehow never made it into the final impact fee. The thinking that I think we need is one that really, I spent a lot of time in the Gulf, and so when I talk about this, I very often talk about our experience in the Gulf. We have to recognize that these kind of incidents that we see in the Gulf happens. This is something I'm not capable of, but I always have a graduate student who's able to Photoshop something to make a picture of this is a comet hitting the deep water horizon. That's what we would call an accident. This is an incident. These are the things that happen, right? They're fully preventable. And when you look at them, and you start looking at the Marcellus Shale violation data in the state of Pennsylvania, these are data put together by Frack Tracker, which is a group that has got a wonderful website. They're basically have taken the violations recorded by the state of Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection and redone the data to do this per well per companies that have 10 or more wells. So they're not the tiniest of companies. They have at least 10 wells, and there's 36 of them there. And as you can see, there's six companies that have zero violations. There's another half dozen or so that have more than twice as many violations as they have wells. There's an enormous difference in how these companies are responding to the challenge of doing this right. And it's a real problem when you start thinking of what is the meaning of this from the global meaning, obviously, is the methane, but the local meaning, the community disruption, has to do with the site that you're near and the company that you're near is governing that. Industry has a valid argument against folks in public health who jump up and down and say, well, if one industry screws up, they're all screwing up. In other words, all the entire oil industry is BP, as it was at the Deepwater Horizon. No. I mean, you know, if you'd have asked any of us who knew something about the field, say that, oh, there's a a Deepwater Horizon-like incident occurring in the Gulf, guess which company? We would have guessed BP, because it does have, did have, that serious record of not paying attention to health and safety issues. It's a local thing that's the most important one. It's not the industry average. The opposite is happening here now. Some of the studies you're going to see are studies, for instance, the Environmental Defense Fund is doing one, DOE is doing another, working with a number of the shale gas operators to measure air pollution, to measure water pollution in the field. Who are they working with? Are they working with the ones who are basically going to cooperate with them voluntarily because they've got this let's go ahead and don't care about the incidents kind of issue? Or are they working with the better companies that are probably going to have none? We're going to see information out there that is basically going to be misleading in terms of what's happening in communities that are being beset by industry that simply doesn't care. The approach that's needed is one that Alcoa has taken. I use this, it's a Pittsburgh example, but Paul O'Neill has been one of my heroes. He came to Alcoa and he said, basically, there is no reason for there to be any accident, incident whatsoever, no lost work time days. It should be zero. That's the only acceptable number. He brought them from 1.86, which was a little better than the industry average, down to next to zero. And he did it mainly by, if you had an OSHA violation and you were the plant manager, it wasn't an issue of was your bonus affected. Did you keep your job? And you probably didn't. And when you have that kind of mentality, you can make a difference for the worker and you can make a difference for the community. And that's the kind of mentality we need. We have other problems, and this also comes out of the Gulf. How many of you have heard about the dispersant that was used in perhaps a million gallons, an unprecedented amount? Raise your hand, you probably all have. And how many of you know what that dispersant is? Yeah. If I ask the question in a Gulf community about how many of you are concerned about the fact that you don't know what it is because there's this organic sulfonic acid salt, which is proprietary, was hidden from you, were you concerned about that? Again, almost everybody would raise their hand. Next question, I purposely say I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many of you have taken a laxative recently over the counter? Because that's what it turns out to be. This organic sulfonic acid salt is one of the most commonly sold laxatives, probably in a million doses a day. Why was this kept secret? I mean, as a toxicologist, I mean, I don't know what it's doing to the fish in the sea, but in terms of a human health effect, I'm not worried about it, right? Okay. But why did it keep this secret? Well, we're getting the same thing happening now. There's been some movement. There's now disclosure language in various state laws, and I won't read through this, which basically says we're going to tell you what's at the local site. We will release that information, except if it's proprietary, confidential business information. And then a physician can get it, but only through a chilling routine. I doubt if any physician is going to ask. That's one problem, but that's part of the communication issue. The focus is on these hydraulic fracturing fluids and whether or not we have to tell you what these fracturing fluids are at the site. The real concern, as I think you've been shown, is the stuff we're bringing up from underground. It's the flowback water. It's all those compounds in there that have to be put somewhere. It's not so much what we're putting down below, which has to be put down below appropriately, but it's what comes up. Where does it go? What do we do with it? And guess what this law says about, and all these laws say about this. This is language that follows almost immediately afterwards. It says, notwithstanding any other provision of this chapter, we don't have to disclose chemicals that were not intentionally added. We don't have to disclose chemicals that occur incidentally or otherwise unintentionally present in trace amounts. This is like saying to the pesticide manufacturers, you know, you didn't intentionally put dioxin in there, and it's only there in trace amounts, so you don't have to tell us about it. No, this violates everything we've learned about public health and environmental health. We need that information, and the industry should be required to tell us about it. Both of these, and this is a digression, are basically poster children for the reform of the U.S. Toxic Substances Control Act, but it's a diversion. There's a management of the message that's going on here that has really been a problem for us in public health. It's managing a message that, let me digress a bit and follow up with the very excellent presentation, Resources for the Future, where we were told that there's 264 different possible scenarios that they're looking at, whether the high risk, low risk. That violates something that I've always been learned is Sutton's Law. Have you ever heard of Sutton's Law? No, it's only his old folks know Sutton's Law. Willie Sutton was a bank robber. He was a very famous bank robber. He's a bit of a folk hero. He'd robbed hundreds of banks, and he kept on escaping, and he was always this meek little guy. And one day he reportedly was asked by a reporter, Willie, why do you rob banks? And supposedly he looked incredulously at the reporter and said, because that's where the money is. Okay. Well, in medicine, that got to be known as Sutton's Law, and you can look this up. There's something called Sutton's Law, which basically says, if somebody, say, comes in with a lymph node, with a big node in the neck, and the question is, what is it? Well, you can do 100 lab tests, another 100 kinds of specialized x-rays and whatnot to find out what it is. You can go take the thing out and look it under a microscope. Sutton's Law says you go and you take it out and look it under the microscope. What are we concerned about here? We're concerned about human health and environmental health. We're not looking at that. We're looking at all these other things. We're worried about the hydrogeology and whether or not the stuff that gets put under the ground gets up above. No, that's not where the action is. These are important questions to ask. The kind of fault tree analysis that Resources for the Future is doing, I think, is really important. We should know what it is that might be a problem. But why are we not looking at what Sutton's Law would tell us to look at if that's the question? What's happening to health and the environment? Okay? What are the other messages that are being managed? There is no proven incident in which hydrofracturing has caused groundwater contamination. Major water contamination has occurred as a result of shale gas drilling activities. These are both correct. They seem to be contradictory. In the first statement has to do with hydrofracturing as the successful release of hydrofracturing chemicals and water 5,000 foot underground. Okay? And there is no proof that it's ever come to the surface. Dr. Witter showed you the possibilities of Pavilion and the argument about that, but there's really no proof that once you get it 5,000 foot underground, it comes to the surface. But there are communities which have had their water taken offline because there's hydrofracturing fluid that has basically destroyed their water supplies. Well, that's because the casing has blown out at the surface. That's because a drum has been run over by a truck. How do you feel if you're a community member and you're reading this first statement? And, well, it has nothing to do with what's affected your water. What the public wants to know is, from the time you get there till 20 years from now when you finally leave, will my groundwater be affected? And that first statement here is not helpful. Okay. Is hydrofracturing old or new? We've been told it's been around for 50, 60 years. Sure it has. But if you look at the commercials that are on television in our area, you'll see that they start off very often with, we've got this wonderful new technology which is going to get us gas, going to get us national security. Well, it can't be both a new technology and an old technology. And the old technology is true. Hydrofracturing was used, but it was used with, say, 50,000 gallons in a straight shot down of maybe a few hundred, 1,000 foot. Now it's being used with 5 million gallons of frack, not 50,000. Incredibly higher pressures. The pipe is being bent horizontally. Holes are being blown out. It's an incredible technology. It's a really wonderful technology. But it's to say this is no different than 50,000 gallons of 50 years ago is simply misleading. And I think industry knows that. Here's the kind of chemicals that are added. Again, this list is for you to have if you want it. But it's just a whole bunch of different chemicals, all of which need to be evaluated, and the interactions among them. As you've heard me say, it's the flowback and produce water constituents, which are the greater concern to me. And again, you've seen these listed in the previous presentations. I would also add mixtures to that. We had a good question about fate and transport. No, that hasn't been looked at, really. But we're looking at mixtures. We're not looking at individual compounds. And these mixtures are changing. The hydrofracking agents, I should have said before, one of the changes has been that they're new and better chemicals that do a better job of being slicker and get out more gas. So you've got changes in these chemicals, and they need to be evaluated not one at a time, but as a mixture. Plus, as a mixture with the chemicals coming up from underground. You've got an unholy mixture there that needs to be evaluated as we would carefully evaluate any other potential mixture that would get to the public. That's not being done. It's needed. The point source issue, you saw a little bit about this from Roxana Winter's presentation, and I'll only add to the fact that if you look at the And just look at the top one, the 8-hour ozone designations. Once you get into the Northeast, you're in areas of the country that are very close to being in non-attainment for the ozone standard. And the ozone standard may get tightened because of the evidence of of increased mortality due to ozone. The irony here is that if you have many different individual sources, which can't be controlled because they're not exceeding the threshold for any one source, but there's 1,000 of them, and they lead to enough precursors that you end up exceeding the ozone standard, well, when you exceed the ozone standard, your approach is a state implementation plan, which very often has to force you to limit your industrial development. But what we're being sold here is how this is going to increase our industrial development. So how do we work with that without being a little bit more careful than we are right now? The drinking water health issues, the norm, the naturally occurring radioactive materials are an issue that has to do with not only the buildup of scale, which is highly radioactive from the radioactive components of the natural gas, that's well known in the industry as a whole, in the oil industry. And by the way, it's yet another loophole in our laws that basically say we've got to worry about radiation if it's at a certain level, and if you're in a hospital, you have to wear a badge or something. Not for the folks who are dealing with radiation in pipelines. They're exempted from that. But there's some studies, I shouldn't say studies, some back-of-the-envelope models by Marvin Resnikoff, who argues that if you're going to end up getting natural gas in the New York metropolitan area where he's done his work from, instead of getting it from Louisiana, you're going to get it from Scranton. Well, radon that's naturally present and doesn't, anytime you turn your gas burner on in your home, the radon's going to come out in the air. You're not going to burn it off, so it gets into the home. The radon that's naturally present will have a much shorter time in the pipeline when it comes from Scranton. And radon's got a half-life of about 3.5 days. It takes supposedly about 12 days to get from the Gulf to the New York metropolitan area. It'll take only 3 days from the Scranton area, so you're going to end up with far more radiation than you would have otherwise. There are data out there debunking that. I don't know what's true, but I do know that we're not seeing the kind of data we need to find out whether or not it's true. The community engagement, I think, is absolutely needed. I think you well understand that. Public health surveillance is needed. We're not getting it in the way we ought to. The states have generally been lax. Certainly Pennsylvania has been among the most lax in terms of putting together the needed surveillance approaches that just respond to the public concern. It's so frustrating for people out there who just can't get the information they need. Sustainability. This seems to me to be a key approach that's needed. We have to get away from just doing risk approaches to thinking of this in terms of sustainability. It's transdisciplinary, it's the trade-off analysis, and again, the multi-generational equity, the longer-term effects is important. And let me close by saying I see only three certainties. I've told you one, which is surprises. A second one is disease clusters. There's lots of communities. Inevitably, we know that diseases come in clusters. Some of the clusters are just statistical variations, flipping coins with, somebody will flip 10 heads in a row in a room this size. But when it's going to happen now, the community is going to turn around and say, we didn't have these kids with autism or people with pancreatic cancer or pick your disease until they put up that big rig. It must be due to that. And what will happen then is what always happens. The media will get involved. Property values will go down. People will be mad at each other about this whole thing. The plaintiff's bar will get involved. Plaintiff's bar is already having meetings about the Marcellus Shale and how to best position themselves on this issue. And industry is going to lose. I mean, the people in the community are going to vote against them. We have, some of you remember the MTBE issues of 20 years ago. Well, there are people now getting major judgments against major oil companies with punitive damages because the plaintiff's bar is able to show that in the early 1990s, what appears to be a pattern of the industry hiding the information they knew about the methyl tert-butyl ether. Same thing's going to happen now, 10, 15, 20 years from now. The information suggests that industry is intentionally trying to avoid doing the kind of research that needs to be done that would basically provide some sort of baseline to understand whether or not there really is an increase in autism or pancreatic cancer or whatever. Finally, there's going to be less pollution over time. Industry finds ways to recycle the fracking chemical and emit less of the product which they sell, which includes the methane. I would recast what we've heard about methane a little and greenhouse gas a little differently. I don't care whether it's 1% or 7% that's being emitted. Whatever the level is, it ought to be brought down because it's a greenhouse gas and it's not doing us any good to emit it. And so the force ought to be there, and it's not this thing of, well, it's only 2%, so therefore we don't have to do anything. That's the wrong approach. The approach is that whatever it is, it should be lessened. Industry makes money out of selling this product. They should be forced to do it by appropriate regulations. Thank you very much.